people genuinely want to help each other. You can see this desire to help whenever there's a crisis in the world, and people respond by wanting to do something about it. Searches for how to help are higher now than at any time in Google Trends history. I've always felt all data should be public and open. That's why I love getting to work with this stuff, because it's all anonymized. It's all like you can't look at individual searches. It's aggregated to cities. That makes it an incredibly valuable tool. We should use it.
It's said there's no such thing as a stupid question, but I can certainly think of a few stupid ones I've asked, a few I've been asked, and lots more that have been left hanging for fear of embarrassment. More often than not, the fear of judgment gets the better of us and the question remains unasked. And if you think that fear is limited to not being embarrassed in front of colleagues at work or fellow students, think again. Before we even consult friends and family, according to YouGov data, about 68% of people feel more comfortable searching the internet to answer their questions first. Google handles over 13.7 billion searches per day, a treasure trove of information about what we worry about. That translates to, wait for it, 189,815 searches per second, from how we boil an egg to what is love. There are no limits to what we ask the internet and Google in a world that we have come to feel and believe is becoming ever more polarized. Google Trends data shows us a much more optimistic outlook, though we're actually more similar than we think we are. So what do our search results reveal about us, and how are cultural mores shift and change in line with real-world events? How can Google Trends, one of the world's largest real-time datasets, help us to understand the world around us? Well, here to help sift through this mountain of data, fascinatingly, is Simon Rogers, author of What We Ask Google, published earlier this year. He's an award-winning data journalist, writer and speaker, co-host of the Data Journalism podcast, and author of Facts Are Sacred. He's based in San Francisco, where he works as data editor at Google. But today, he's sitting in front of me in London. Simon, I mean, just before we, have this wonderful, dip into this treasure trove, just what's your role at Google? What's Google Trends? What's the authority of which you speak?
So Google Trends, I should start there, is, as you said, probably the world's biggest data set. It's certainly the world's biggest accessible data set. You can go on to trends.google.com and search for yourself. And it's basically a sample of all searches, about a fifth of all searches. It has data from 5 minutes ago, but it has data back to 2004. And it really is the kind of the world's brain, essentially, kind of this. It's a constantly changing engine. The engineers call it an engine. They don't even call it a data set because it's always changing. It's always kind of ephemeral. It reacts to whatever happens today in the news. But there's also a constancy to the data too. It'll tell us about, as you say, the things that we care about every day, whether it's relationships or health or our families, that sort of thing. And my role is as data editor at Google. So essentially, really...
Are you the data editor?
I am the only one.
Really?
Well, partly I'm the only
one.
You're
the man.
I'm the only one who wanted that title. There's lots of people who work with data at Google. For me, though, because I was coming from the newsroom, and I used to work at The Guardian. For me, it was really about telling stories with that data, and anything where the data is made public. So we do a project, for instance, called Year in Search. Any time you see Google Trends out in the world, my team's probably had some involvement with that.
Now, can we got to get to brass tacks? Come on, let's dig into this. I'm tempted to ask you, and if you think it's a kind of damn silly question, you can push back. But what's the most arresting fact or series of facts that you want to lay out in front of us?
Wow. Okay. I'm going to give you three kind of things which are more general. We can dive into them specifically. But the things that really emerged to me, and it wasn't me going in and deciding this was going to be the structure of the book. It was absolutely what emerged from the data. One of which is
It's a great book, by the way. Really fascinating stuff,
Thanks, Will. It's basically, firstly, we know nothing. We need help with everything, whether it is how to tie a tie or how to boil an egg. Secondly, we are less alone than I think we are. There is a crisis of loneliness out there in the world, and I think people often feel like they're the only person in a given situation. But what you see is that there are millions of other people in the same our situation. And the third thing that emerges, and possibly the most important, is that people genuinely want to help each other. You can see this desire to help whenever there's a crisis in the world, and people respond by wanting to do something about it. Searches for how to help are higher now than at any time in Google Trends history. So those three trends, really emerged. I didn't go into it trying to write that book, but they really came out once I started looking at the data in that way.
Now, some people listening to this will say, that's all very well, but I mean, you know, Google has got billions of searches a day, a couple of 100,000 every second. I mean, how many of these are British? Does the British data conform to the rest of the world? So, I mean, are there any outliers in all of this story?
Yeah, what you see is that there are some trends which emerge which are unique to different places, wherever they are, and some which are constant wherever you are in the world. So, you know, in Britain, every year in June, there is a spike for how to help a bee, which feels to me like the most English search ever. But that spikes everywhere, but it spikes most in the UK. London is also the top place searching for how to tell time drunk, which I don't know, they might say something else. And then there are some trends which are kind of have become global. And sometimes they're around news events, they're around helping or whatever. But things like, I have a son who's just finished high school in the States, and you see searches around prom spiking in the US, obviously. It's a very American thing. And when I was a kid, we didn't have prom. Now, English kids go to prom. And you see those searches that started in the States kind of spreading around the world. And there's lots of things like that around food, around health. So there are things, obviously, that are uniquely English, uniquely British, but there are a lot of things that we have in common with people you might not expect. The top place searching for Liverpool Football Club is Kisangati, you know, in Uganda, I believe. So, it's, you know, the trends are a weird reflection of humanity that shows the kind of the uniqueness, but also the similarities.
Well, it's quite encouraging. I mean, I wherever we are, we demonstrate our humanity, and we're not quite the kind of haters that actually social media kind of sometimes suggests we are. I mean, that doesn't seem to show up in the data.
I mean, obviously, look, search is a reflection of society. You're going to find all sorts of things. People always ask me, you know, isn't it all terrible? Aren't people horrible? And actually, I would say, you know, think about the people you know in your life, like how many of them are genuinely awful people. I think, you know, you see the bulk of the data is really about this everyday stuff. It's about what's on TV tonight, what am I going to make for dinner, how do I care for my parents, how do I care for my kids, things like that. It's not what I expected, of course. You know, I expected it would be different, but actually you just see it again and again that it's our daily lives. And I deliberately wrote the book about those kind of everyday moments because I thought, well, I didn't want it to date. I wanted it to last and be a kind of snapshot of this first two decades of search data that we've got going back to 2004. But also I wanted it to kind of reflect people's lives because I hadn't seen anybody do that. And in a way, it's not really a book about the internet. It's a book about us through this tool that we all use.
The humanity of it is striking as well. When Google's asked, you know, what's love, how can you supply an answer? How can you get
this
to an answer?
This is the interesting thing, because a lot of the searches are not things with yes or no answers. And you see them mixed. So one of the things I've got quite early on is I just dug up the top 20 searches, like, of all time. And some of them are things like, what is my IP, or how to...
What is your IP, or my intellectual property?
It means your IP address.
Okay.
And some things like how many ounces in a cup, that sort of thing. But then there are things like, and there are things that how to do things, how to make pancakes or how to tie a tie.
I was struck by how banal that top 20 were, actually.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's one of the things I love about it. But then bang in the middle, you've got, like, you know, what is love? Or how to know somebody likes me? Or how to kiss a girl, how to kiss a boy, those kind of things.
Can I come back to love? I mean, I'm just seeing, you know, it's a search engine. It's asked, what's love? It has to provide answers. Now, I mean, I should have actually done that before starting this interview with you and see what you came up with. But yeah. I thought I'd reserve that to ask the man himself. I mean, you provide some answers in your chapter on love, don't you?
Often I'm asked, why do you think this thing's trending? And I'll say, I don't know why it was trending, but this thing was happening at the same time. And I try and avoid it because I feel like that's not my job. I think if you're writing about, say, what people's searches, and you're in a newsroom, fine, you can speculate all you want. For me, I wanted to be sure of stuff so I could see. And there are certain trends that are just odd or unique. Like there was one that I wrote about in the language chapter, which was I was looking for searches for how to say thank you. Because I thought it was interesting, the way that people search for how to say thank you in different cultures.
Yes.
There was this one trend, which was how to say thank you for an unexpected gift. You see these things sometimes, and they're almost like ghosts in the machine because the data's so big and it's changing, the sample shifts. I thought, well, that's interesting. And the place that was searching for it was Niger, which I don't know anything about Niger apart from what I've read in the papers. You know the troubles the country has had.
Yeah.
I was thinking, and also it's a French-speaking country, so why isn't English search spiking there? Is it like aid workers searching for something? This was one of the cases where I actually wanted to explain it. So I was trying to find somebody from Niger to talk to, and it turns out I didn't know anybody, any Nigerians. And I found a NASA hydrologist called Dr. Faji Minor, tracked her down on LinkedIn and sent her a message, said, I'm really sorry. I know that, you know, obviously this is not to do hydrology, but could you help me explain this particular trend? And she wrote back and explain this whole kind of culture of giving in Niger. If you turn up to somebody's house, you have to have a gift with you, even if it's just like an egg or something. You would keep stuff in your house to give to people as well. And so learning that about a culture about which I knew nothing, you know, through search data was incredibly kind of fascinating to me.
And searches are different by time of day. I mean,
yes, there is a clock to the day. I mean, there's a clock to the year as well. Yeah, we search for different things at different times of year.
Well, obviously Christmas gifts and all the rest of it.
Yeah, but Christmas has also had to play piano in Christmas. That spikes in December. But in January, it's like how to pay off debt, for instance. You know, so you see different things at different times. And then, in fact, that kind of rhythm of search, it gives you really interesting things about the way we search different times of day. People search for why isn't my baby sleeping at 2 a.m, for instance. And during the day, we search for, you know, meals, like dinner time at like late morning and that sort of thing. And then in the evening, they tend to be things that are much more kind of metaphysical, almost existential questions about, you know, what are we doing with our lives? So those rhythms are really interesting. And actually, that's kind of where trends comes from, because Hal Varian, who used to be Google's chief economist, wrote a paper about nowcasting using Google Trends. And he's actually one of the reasons trends exist, because he noticed there were patterns in the data.
Nowcasting?
Yeah. So essentially, I understand this economics term, but essentially you can see from data now about what might happen in the future. So because a lot of searches are like this kind of database of intentions, you might look for vacations now. You're not going to go on holiday tomorrow, probably. You're probably going to go in a few weeks. So if you can start, and people search for jobless benefits way ahead of when official statistics show unemployment spiking. So there is a kind of predictive value, I guess, to the way that people search, or that rhythm, that those patterns, annual patterns of searches throughout the year that you wouldn't expect. So the OECD has used Google Trends to predict.
That's the Organization of Economic Development. I mean, they're using Google Trends?
They've used it to predict weekly GDP. Obviously, GDP is quarterly, isn't it? So imagine if you can look at trends in, you know, purchasing and hiring and that sort of thing, model that with a bit of AI. And that's essentially what they did. And they built a whole model for this is how to use trends to predict a weekly GDP figure.
Of course, that would work much better with kind of retail consumption, much less well with business, I would imagine.
Yeah, I would think so. It's much more about what we do as humans. But I guess if you think that a lot of official statistics are essentially guesses, they're great guesses, perhaps. They're well-informed guesses, but they're still guesses. So if trends can kind of enhance that, I think that's interesting, isn't it?
It is. I mean, we talked about prediction markets on this podcast, and, you know, in a way, you know, we social scientists have to kind of grapple with new data sources and what they tell us and how to use them. This is the Academy of Social Sciences, and I'm the president. I should ask you, you know, have you any advice to the social scientists listening to this podcast about what Google Trends might be able to help them with?
There has been quite a lot of academic research using trends. I think we're at a very early stage. This is the problem. We've only had trends data since, I want to say, like late 90s. we've got...
It started in 2004, you were saying.
So we've got data back to there, but,
yeah.
you know, like,
yeah,
they
okay,
were using,
okay, okay. Yeah,
using
yeah,
earlier
yeah,
versions
yeah, yeah,
of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, we've only had real-time search data since 2015. I write in the book, I feel a bit like an archaeologist sometimes. You're kind of uncovering stuff. I think as a source, it's interesting. Probably mostly interesting if you combine it with something else. I've seen people like Charlie Cook of the Cook Report, which is polling, but he has used trends... to kind of complement polling, to look at long-term interest in different kind of social issues and so on.
It was interesting, actually, in the because one of the ways that pollsters try and correct answers is to say, you know, so you ask a respondent, you know, so which way you're going to vote in the coming election, and then you say, well, now tell us which way you voted 2, 3, 4 years earlier.
Yeah.
And they try to get a handle on whether there's seriousness of intent here.
Right.
But Google, I mean, Google Trends might be able to kind of do better than that. I mean, I'm just trying to think ways in which, or in consumer behavior, or reading, one might respond to the effectiveness of an advert. Or lots of stuff that you can do, isn't there?
I mean, I think so. I mean,
by the way, and is it sinister? There's a dark side to this too, isn't there? I mean, the information that's, I mean, it's all anonymized, I know, but I mean,
yeah, I mean, it's all. I would say, I mean, obviously, my take is that all data should be public, and this is the biggest public data set there is. I think it's good because it's data that belongs to us as humans, I believe, really. It's about our...
Such, you know, a benign fellow gazing at me across this studio.
This is my feelings about data. I've always felt all data should be public and open. That's why I love getting to work with this stuff, because it's all anonymized. It's all like you can't look at individual searches. It's aggregated to cities. That makes it an incredibly valuable tool. We should use it. And we've seen people like the UN refugee organizations using it in refugee crisis in like Afghanistan and Gaza.
In what way?
Well, basically, because you can see what people are searching for at different places. So are there needs that could be fulfilled in that place that are emerging? Like, you know, it could be, where do I get food? Or how do I get to here? You know, or, you know, you saw that when the Ukraine invasion happened, like there's a big spike of searches in Poland for translation, you know, for road signs, that sort of thing, of people just who crossed the border and needed to know where they were. And that's like a practical use.
Just a brief pause in the conversation to tell you a bit about the Academy of Social Sciences, which is the organization behind the We Society podcast. I'm Will Hutton, the president of the Academy of Social Sciences. We're a national body for academics, practitioners, and learned societies in the social sciences. We champion the vital role of social science in our society, from education to government and business. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. China doesn't really permit Google search, does it?
Yeah.
I mean, does Iran permit Google search?
So there are those holes in the data, and I talk about those a bit in the book. So we don't get anything meaningful from China, and if it does show up, it's probably VPNs. It'd be great if we did, but we don't. So, yeah, this is a partial picture of the world for sure.
And one of the three things you singled out at the very beginning of this was loneliness.
Mm.
And one of the things that we've explored in the podcast is this phenomenon of loneliness and the importance, you know, happy people eat together with family and friends frequently. Is it on the increase over the last, since 2004? People that are questioning about it? Is this another proxy for, as an indicator of how people are feeling about being alone?
Definitely. I mean, you can see, you know, there is... The former Surgeon General in the US issued a report on this, and this crisis of loneliness, especially since COVID. And you can see searches for loneliness, searches for anxiety are higher now than they've been in, like, Google Trends history.
Really?
Yeah, and a lot of it is interesting. A lot of it is about, weirdly, is not just about us. It's about other people. So searches around anxiety, you know, that's one of the top how to help somebody with anxiety, for instance. I started writing the book a couple of months after my mum died. I felt incredibly lonely at that point, even though I had loved ones around me who were being lovely. And those moments, you do feel like you're the only person in that situation. And
because, I mean, here you are in
yeah.
Britain, but I mean, you are...
I'm based in the States.
You're based in the States.
I was actually in the... When I started writing it, I was... My son used to do a lot of mountain biking, and we were off at a race in the middle of nowhere, no Wi-Fi. So I actually started writing... I had kind of collected data around grief searches before I went. I thought, right, I'm going to start... I'll try this, because if this works, the book will work. And also... This will be the hardest chapter to do.
Did your mother's death, was that? I mean, my mother's obviously, I'm older than you, and, you know, my mother died.
Only just about
10 years ago, 9 years ago, actually. And of course, it was, you know, she's in her 90s, and we'd all mentally prepared for it, actually. It was still quite shocking when it happened.
Yeah.
I remember the night before she died, singing Louis Armstrong songs with her, you know. She said to me, you know, there's a lot of people here, William. And I said, Well, Mum, we think we might be approaching the final curtain. She said, final curtain, I just got a bad cold. But I mean, the thing was that I was prepared.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I felt we saw her out well. But your mother's death seems to have really hit you. I'm just trying to get under the skin of that. You write about that in your book very movingly, you know.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I think that it was a shock, although not surprising. Let me say, she'd been ill, but she died of something in the end that was utterly preventable, which is... It's the way off, and yes, just an infection that probably could have been solved by antibiotics. But that's the bargaining talking.
Was it really unexpected?
She, you know, like a lot of people, she'd had a fall. She'd been in hospital, come home, seemed okay, and then went downhill very quickly. My brother and I, like, were both kind of shocked. We were both, he was visiting me in the States when it happened. Of course, so we were 5,000 miles away.
Yeah.
And I think for me, it was that feeling of, like, wanting to understand it, wanting to be able to cope with it, having some control over my reaction to it, which is like you can't. Partly it was I wanted to be able to not to start crying at inopportune moments, you know, very English perhaps response to it. But what I found in the data, which was interesting, was that obviously I was asking questions other people were asking, you know, feeling lonely but not being alone. And then the other thing was that a lot of the questions that are being asked were by other people trying to help people in my situation. Yeah, and I could see that in the way my family were responding with me, but the stuff, you know, about what's the right thing to say, what can I do to help, those kind of things. And that was incredibly
That's
reassuring.
A very interesting point. I've written many letters of condolence in my life, you know, sadly. It never occurs to me, by the way, to ask Google how I should
People ask for help to write poetry or to find that quote, you know, as if that's the only thing. But also it's like kind of knowing what the right thing to say is, because I think grief makes people uncomfortable, doesn't it?
But again, I mean, I'm struck. A lot of people, after hearing this, will want to, when they ask Google questions about what is love or, you know, how do I express condolences, will kind of wonder about the intelligence and the sources of the replies they're getting. I mean, they need to interrogate them, don't they? I mean...
Yeah, I think like...
Do you have a hand in that, by the way?
So I'm definitely on the what we ask side of the operation. I don't deal with, you know, the other side of the internet. I didn't want to get into that in the book because I think, you know, the internet is ever-changing. Some of it's great, some of it's not great. I think, but this is about, to me, this phenomenon. And maybe this phenomenon is something that's going to seem like history in 10 years' time because of the way that search is changing or AI is affecting what we do. That, you know, this idea of like how we have taken to this as a kind of source of advice or a source of help is something that I've not seen anybody explore. It's like, and the fact that maybe...
No, that's what makes the book original. I mean,
well, thank you. It's also, I think,
no more name checks from me about how good the book is.
Please pray continue. But I think that that we almost kind of, we not only expect people to be terrible, but we're almost a bit disappointed, perhaps, by the fact that that's not what the data shows. To me, anyway, I don't know. It's interesting, but I think that this idea of like whatever the results are, and I say this in the health chapter, you know, like obviously you go to a doctor, you know, it's very important. But I think that
there's quite a lot of that, isn't there? And you're quite sober about that.
I think I've tried
to take it too seriously. You know, don't get yourself a hypochondriac.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, and I as somebody who searched for 14 different things about myself, yeah, every day, I'm very conscious of that. But I think that, you know, this idea of like what it says about us as humans, about, and partly I think sometimes it is about exerting some kind of control. So one of the chaps I looked at searches around COVID and how they evolved, and that was fascinating to me because you had this in this disease that was happening to different places at different times.
Yeah.
So you could see patterns in different countries. And what you would see was that in the initial phase of COVID, they were all what questions. What is COVID? What can I do? What are the symptoms? That sort of thing. And they would switch to being like how questions. Like, how do I make a face mask? How do I protect myself? And I feel like the how side of this is action, is wanting to do something. And often a lot of health searches are about that. They're about information and then they're about action.
But your point is that actually beware, because you can...
For sure.
Because you can decide you're suffering from some kind of killer illness.
But sometimes you can give people all the information in the world. Like, one of the things, you can find a map in the book of searches around the eclipse. The year when I wrote the book, there had been an eclipse down the east coast of the US. And the next day, there is a spike in searches for why do my eyes hurt? And the searches for why do my eyes hurt follow the path of the eclipse down the eastern states.
So I shouldn't laugh.
And how many times have we all been told, do not stare directly at the sun?
Wear
special glasses. So you can give people all the information in the world, but how they act is up to them, plainly.
Now, I mean, there's a whole debate about misinformation on the net, isn't there? I mean, where do you stand personally on that? I mean, I know that you're not responsible for policy at Google, but I mean, are there ways which you think one could be aware of what's misinformation and what's real information? I mean, come on, give us a guide.
I think trends in the misinformation space, I think trends is a really good way to track whether misinformation is taking hold or not. People use it in that way. So the New York Times, for instance, has used it to track rumors or conspiracy theories and see whether they're real or they're fake. There is that desire.
Give us an example of that, actually.
Well, I mean, so one that I saw was the 2020 election. The day after the election, there was a spike in searches in Arizona for Sharpie pens, because there was a very brief-lived conspiracy about Sharpie pens and people voting that I don't believe has still got currency now. But when something happens in the world or they hear about something, people's first thing is to go and search for it. Find out whether it's, what are the facts? What are the facts on? You see it during, election debates. There is always a spike in searches for fact checking.
Yeah,
people. I don't believe that people genuinely want to be misled. I think that the information, the evidence I see is that people want to know what the truth is, or at least the case is about a particular situation.
So the New York Times, and I'm guessing there'll be some British papers who do the same.
Sure.
Can look at Google Trends, and by seeing what kinds of questions are being asked about what phenomena, are picking up what the public think is potentially misinformation.
I think they're picking up whether a piece of misinformation has got legs or not, which is slightly different, isn't it?
Okay,
I think
okay.
They can see how far it's spreading or whether, and it's just one tool I would say in that world, but I think it's a useful one.
Yeah.
Especially if you can see it in real time.
Artificial intelligence, I'm a kind of inveterate Google searcher. It's a wonderful, wonderful tool, actually. And you now kind of reinforced it with AI. But I'm equally aware that, there are people who say that actually artificial intelligence kind of is distorting kind of data that's thrown up in what seems to be a matter-of-fact Google search that must have cascade effects, which kind of must impact on what you're observing when you do Google Trends.
I mean, we've done some research recently about, and we just published it actually a few weeks ago, about how people search using AI. The stuff that we found was that it's definitely changing the way people search. It's not necessarily changing what people search for, is my feeling. And we've only got a year's worth of data. You think we've got like 2 decades of core search, regular search data, and you've got like a year of AI mode searches, but you see that queries are longer, 3 times as long as they used to be, because people like talk to AI like it's a human. They talk in complete sentences and so on. It's much more likely to be what they call multimodal. So in the past, you would search with text, and now you might take a photograph and search with that, or do it by voice and say, because you're standing outside a restaurant, you want to know. And they're much more specific. So before you might say, find me at a Vietnamese restaurant near me. And now you might say, find me at a Vietnamese restaurant near me where I can take 10 people and a birthday cake and stay till. So the queries are definitely shifting. But I think that they are still searching for the same things, just in different ways, because the technology is shifting.
Are you concerned at how much once we are displacing human interaction and human asking of questions and actually displacing it onto machines?
I can only speak for myself in this. I think that it's something we do in addition to, generally. I still interact with my family. You know, me and my son, we're repairing an old BMW M3 at the moment, which is a nightmare of complicated German parts that we're having to locate or track down. And we're doing that together. And that's, to me, is like, you know, and but I'm using search, I'm using AI search, this kind of weird combination of things concurrently to do it. You know, if Google's original mission back in the day was about making the world's information accessible and useful. And that's something that I can sign up to for sure. People have the ability now to ask the world anything. And what we ask is a strange mix of the you know, the sublime and the ridiculous, and that's fine. That's who we are, and the fact that it can change from one minute to the next is great. And I think I also wonder if some of these things are the result of interaction. So, for instance, like the fact that people search for how to boil an egg. It's always one of the top search food questions. How to boil an egg. Always one of the top search food questions. Always has been, to the extent that I think it's either because people are repeatedly forgetting how to boil an egg, which is possible, or they're having a debate saying, how long do you boil? No, it's 3 minutes. No, it's 5 minutes.
The big question, of course, is actually whether you start with the water cold or whether it's boiling.
Well, indeed. Yeah, you see, it's the most, I throw them in, like I just put them in and turn it on, but I like them soft to myself. That's a 2.5 minute job for me.
Well, look, humanity, loving, grieving, boiling an egg, asking different kinds of questions during the day. And you were saying that actually we get more kind of ask more existential questions the more we get into the evening and the early morning. And that one in the morning, you know, becomes very existential. What am I here for? What's the meaning of life?
Yeah.
Whereas at kind of 7 at night, you're asking, which is the restaurant nearest me? I mean, yeah.
Yeah, basically, if you think of us as utterly ephemeral, yeah, there's something we really care about 1 second and then ignore the next. So I try when I'm working with the data, I always try and have a comparator. Like, what is this data compared to? So we always use something like the weather, because the weather is a real constant. It's always highly searched. And some things will go over that, and some things are just little tiny blips. The data that we have will show kind of related searches. So if you search for one thing, what else do you search for within a short period of time? And you'll see, yeah, people search for what's in the news one moment, then they'll be searching for, you know, the Traitors TV show. And that's who we are. I think we're ephemeral, we're changing, we are...
But we're slightly pejorative. And I think that, I mean, you know we're complicated and, you know...
Yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with
that. You just move on, you know.
Exactly, you move on, and I think we're kind, we'll be searching for how to help somebody, and then we'll be searching for how to buy something, and it's fine. Those things live in coexistence.
How to help somebody, and I think we should just explore that before we finish. I mean, this is that we're basically altruists, we're basically sympathetic to the misfortunes of others, we're anxious to do what we can to alleviate suffering. Those are good qualities that you are kind of uncovering on Google Trends.
I mean, honestly, like, I think if you looked at search data, you know, you come to explore these humans, you looked at search data, and that's what you would see. So when there's a crisis, there's a refugee crisis, say, or a fire or whatever it is, first thing people search for is how to help people in that place. You see people search for how to donate blood. And I think that it's so ubiquitous now. That's what makes the data really powerful. If you're interested in data, and I think probably a lot of your listeners are, having a data set that essentially is contributed to by pretty much everybody in a country, that's something, a sample that is very hard to get in other ways. And I think the question really is what people can do with it, which I think is something I can't answer, because there are so many things that it could be used to help for.
I mean, there are things like the Social Attitude Survey, which comes out, you know, systematically and regularly. Political scientists, sociologists use this data to kind of see where the center of gravity of people's values are. Are you saying that actually that's all fine, but actually double check your findings with trends on Google Trends?
I think, yeah, or the converse. I think it works best as a source of data used with something else, kind of mashing up of data sets. Incredibly useful for that. It might complement them in other ways, or it might tell you something completely different. But I think using it with something, don't just rely on it on its own, but don't just... I think you could apply that to other data sets as well. Polling, for instance. How many issues are there around polling data? So being able to combine those data sets together could really tell you something interesting.
Well, we may have inspired some of our social science listeners to kind of engage with Google Trends. Others, I think, will have been encouraged to learn about people's essential humanity. There's a constant debate, you know, in religion and philosophy, you know, is are men and women fallen? Are they condemned to do bad? Or no, they have traces of the divine. Actually, they'll do good. Actually, Google Trends is suggesting that we're better than we think.
I think so.
A last thought from you, Simon. A last sign-off thought.
Well, I will just leave it with this, that one of the top searched, can you keep something as a pet, is can you keep a panda as a pet? And I'm here to tell you that no, people, you cannot keep a panda as a pet.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Will.
Thank you. A great podcast. Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends, and thank you so much for listening.